Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Thank you so much for taking time on a Saturday to join us from wherever you are in the world. This is the first Conversation on Buddha Nature event of this year, 2022. So on behalf of everyone at Sadra Foundation, we wish you all a healthy and happy new year. You can see all the past events on the Buddha Nature Resource website, and they're now available as both video and audio recordings that you can download and play anytime. Please feel free to send questions with the Q&A function on Zoom or on Facebook comments during this discussion, and we'll have time set aside for questions at the end. So Conversations on Buddha Nature is a series of online interviews with Buddhist practitioners, scholars, and thinkers on the topic of Buddha Nature. And for this event, Lopan Dr. Karma Punso will speak with the renowned speaker, author, editor, and translator, Thupten Jinpa. So we're honored to have Geshe La Rampa, Dr. Thupten Jinpa, with us here today. And Sadra Foundation has supported the translation work of his Institute of Tibetan Classics for many years. And we've collaborated on many different projects with Jinpa, including the Masterclass with Wisdom Publications, The Art of Translating Tibetan, and creating the Translation and Transmission Conference series, which we hope will continue in the future when the pandemic abates. So a former Tibetan monk with a BA in philosophy and a PhD in religious studies, both from Cambridge University, Thupten Jinpa has a unique and refreshing perspective I'm sure you will all enjoy today. Since 1985, he has been the principal English translator to His Holiness the Dalai Lama and has translated and edited numerous books by the Dalai Lama, including the New York Times bestsellers Ethics for the New Millennium and The Art of Happiness. Jinpa's own publications include works in Tibetan, English translations, as well as books, the latest being Tsongkhapa, A Buddha in the Land of Snows, and Illuminating the Intent, a translation of Tsongkhapa's commentary on Entering the Middle Way, which is the Madhyamakavatara of Chandrakirti. Really exciting translation that has come out. His current projects include an anthology of translations from the Library of Tibetan Classics on the Bodhisattva Ideal that Sadra Foundation is supporting, and the editing of classical Indian Buddhist texts from the Tengir for a special anthology known as the Gyashung Neche Damjik, or Selected Indian Buddhist Treaties. He is also the main author of the Compassion Cultivation Training, an 8-week formal program developed at Stanford University, and co-founder and president of the Compassion Institute, as well as being the chair of Mind and Life Institute, the founder of the Institute of Tibetan Classics, and an adjunct professor at the School of Religious Studies at McGill University. So you all also know Lopan Dr. Karma Punso, the recipient of Sadra Foundation's Writer in Digital Residence. He's our host for these conversations on Buddha Nature. And Karma Punso is one of Bhutan's leading intellectuals, completed both monastic training in the Tibetan traditions, as well as a doctorate at Oxford. He is the founder of the Lodin Foundation in Bhutan, and his work is well known across the Himalayas and in Buddhist study circles around the world. So without much further ado, please welcome Thupten Jinpa joining us from Quebec and Karma Punso joining us from Bhutan.
Tashidele, Geshe-la, and Kuzo Zangpo from Thimphu. Before we get into the conversation, let's spend a few moments to cultivate bodhicitta, to bring our awareness to here and now, and wish that this session will be beneficial to both oneself and others. So, Geshe-la, welcome again to the Conversations on Buddha Nature. You were here in 2020 when we launched this series. It's wonderful to see you again. And as you know, through these conversations, we are trying to create a forum where we can exchange ideas and experiences regarding Buddha Nature. And by doing so, also promote the culture of mindful listening, right speech, and a wholesome exploration of the nature of life, meaning of life. And sort of promotes the idea of the concept of Buddha nature through such conversations. And to me, I've always been an admirer of you, as you are a star of the Tibetan intellectual world, a champion in formulating Tibetan Buddhist philosophy to modern audience, and especially in its encounter with the ideas from the West and also interface with science. So it's so exciting to have you here to share your thoughts and ideas regarding Buddha nature in such ways. And as always, I would like to begin by asking you a little bit about yourself, your spiritual journey, and especially if you can relate that to the Buddha nature teachings, if you can remember when you first got the Buddha nature teachings, if you remember any kind of impression you had then. So please share a little bit about yourself, especially in relation to Buddha nature.
Kishina. Thank you. First of all, I would like to thank Sada Foundation and Marcus for introducing me. And as Marcus said, I've had the privilege to collaborate with Sada on many projects. And thank you, Dr. Lokama Punzola, for inviting me to be a conversation partner in this very important series. And as you reminded us that I had the privilege to be present at the inaugural kind of opening ceremony. So, and also let me take this opportunity to express my own deep admiration of your work. Being trained in Western academia as well, you chose not to be spending your life and work in the West, but actually returning to your own community and helping many younger members of the younger generation to be able to intellectually and rationally and emotionally connect with their own important cultural heritage. And you chose to do that by being back in Bhutan. And I see you as a beacon of light for this new generation, especially in today's time when there are so many things that are competing for the attention of our members of a younger generation, and your voice and rooted in both in classical Buddhist tradition, as well as the skills and methodology of the contemporary academic approach, combining them, you are playing a very important role. So let me take this opportunity to share this. Specifically to your question, probably the first time I encountered the concept of Buddha nature was really in my second year at Ganden Monastery as a student. Before that, I was a member of a ritual monastery, Dzongkha Chöde. And Dzongkha Chöde, other than ritual practices and chanting, there is no formal scholarship at the time, but now they have changed it. And so in the second year of my study at Ganden, we were introduced to the concept of Rig Gotra, which is translated sometimes as Buddha lineage or Buddha potential. And this is part of the study of Parchin. And there, as part of the explanation of the concept of Buddha lineage or Gotra, then the Tathagata Garbha Buddha nature concept emerges. And that was also the first time I had a chance to read Ranagoda Vibhaga, Maitreya's text. And one thing that struck me was this idea that, some kind of essence of the Buddha is already present in us, even as, afflicted human beings, unenlightened. And that also I noticed the way in which this concept has been engaged in Tibetan tradition is also quite multifaceted. So it was quite, for me, encountering this concept initially through the kind of the Gotra concept, and later looking at, and also my own teacher, Zemirambache, actually made me memorize the first chapter of Ratnagotra Vibhaga, because he said Ratnagotra Vibhaga is a very unique Indian treatise. So that was how I first came into contact with the concept of Buddha nature.
That's fascinating, Gisela. Ratnagotra Vibhaga Jutlama, or the ultimate continuum as we are translating in English. It's not a common text in the regular Gelugpa curriculum, is it? And for you to memorize the first chapter, which is the most crucial, it's very unique in the Gelugpa education system, I suppose. And your teacher, Zenme Rinpoche, has also authored a kind of an annotative commentary on the Ratnagotra Vibhaga.
I mean, actually, although Ratnagotra Vibhaga is not a text as part of the formal curriculum, you know, depending upon the sort of, you know, the capability of the students, sometimes it is studied alongside the text on the section on the gotra. So, for example, like in Sera Che and Changze monastery colleges, and their own textbook author has written a specific section on gotra, and in his general presentation of the gotra, there is an extensive section on Ratnagotra Vibhaga, mm-hmm. particularly the 9 examples and 9 points. So it is, it is not included as a formal text to be studied, but it is actually studied as well. I mean, it depends on the different colleges, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Sera J. I was at Sera J for a year and a half or so, and Sera Jitsin has done an excellent work on the gotra and almost cited the entire first chapter of And Gisela, you in your work, you have also included Sera Jitsin's treatise in the compilation, the collection of writings on Buddha nature you did. Can you tell us a little bit about this collection, which you did as part of the Library of Tibetan Classics?
Well, the one of the main aim behind Life of the Tibetan Classics is to bring together in a manageable body of texts. So here, 32 volumes, because we chose 32, because 32 is an auspicious number because of the 32 major marks of the Buddha and all of this. And me being a Tibetan, auspiciousness or tashiba dende is an important concept. But the main idea was to bring together in a manageable collection important texts that would represent important areas of interest and scholarship and practice across all Tibetan Buddhist traditions. So, of course, Buddha nature is a very important topic and a discipline. And when making that selection, I wanted to have a much more inclusive collection. And and since we were going to have Rijung and Dengyazo, Tolpopa's important treatise on definitive meaning separately as a self-standing volume, we did not include any Chonang text in the collection. But other than that, we began with Pudun's beautiful exposition on ornament, you know, ornament beautifying the Buddha nature, which is essentially a kind of an explication of the key sections of the sutras, you know, and trying to come up with an understanding. And then we have Kamaba Ranjung Doji's beautiful text. It's a short one, the Xianyingbu Denpa Denju, so a treatise on the Buddha nature, which is in verse. And there is a commentary by the 15th Karmapa Kagyab Doji on that text. So we wanted to include this because Kamaba Ranjung Doji brings a very unique perspective on the Buddha nature, where he actually makes connection with Tantra in the end, towards the end of the text, which I think is an important move. Whereas you don't see that in previous exegesis of Buddha nature. Of course, in Tolpopa's, we have quite extensive. And then we have Rongdon's commentary on the Ratnagotra Vibhaga, because it is, in terms of length, it's actually the right size. And then we have Shajia Choten's commentary on, praise to the sphere of reality, which is attributed to Nagarjuna, Dharmatatustva. And then we have Jitun Chogyi Gyaltsen's Chitun, which I find really helpful, especially for beginners, because it's a very good introductory text, sort of laying out the terrain and mapping out the main ideas. And then finally, we have Chumi Pam's beautiful text called Singing Arrow, the Xianyingbu Singing Arrow, Lion's Roar, which is essentially a very, very clear explanation of the crucial passage, you know, one stanza. So that's the sort of, and that way we can broadly represent the perspectives of different traditions and scholars on that important topic. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, a wise person often answers the questions before it's being asked. I was actually wondering, you know, why there was no Jonangpa representation or representative in that volume. You have answered that. Is there any plan for this collection to be translated in English, or is it being translated right now?
It is being translated. Actually, it's one of the volumes that was assigned to be translated very, very early on. So the rough draft has been done quite a while ago, but the last stage of editing is taking quite long, partly because the translator ran into quite a lot of personal, adverse situations. And it's been challenging to try to sort of find a balance where we can round it up. But it is in the final stages, and it's one of the volumes funded by Tsadra as well. And my hope is that it probably will be out sometime next year, hopefully. But it has already been translated, yeah.
Well, thank you. So these writings and also the other writings, I mean, numerous, countless writings on Buddha nature, you find across all Buddhist traditions, relate Buddha nature also to emptiness. So coming to our topic today of creative sort of synthesis of Buddha nature and emptiness, especially in the sort of tradition you come from or where you received your main education, Buddha nature is pretty much seen as just emptiness, isn't it, Geshe-la? So for the audience, if you can give a very quick summary of the understanding you find in the writings of Tsongkhapa, which, as Marcus introduced, you have just come out with the biography of Tsongkhapa, as well as the Illuminating Intent, a commentary on Chandrakirti's Entering the Middle Way. So what does the Tsongkhapa and the main Gelug authors say on Buddha nature?
Well, the Tsongkhapa himself did not write any substantially explicitly on the topic of Buddha nature, other than some remarks here and there. But his own position on what he would have said explicitly, for example, if he were to have composed a commentary on Ratnagotavibhaga, is, you know, one can kind of infer. But one thing that I would like to bring out is that one of the tensions is in the literature, whether you look at non-Gelug or Gelug text, is how do we relate to the actual concept and the phrase Buddha nature itself, the Shenyingpo. So the way in which the Gelugpas have generally read the concept is the Shenyingpo Chen. So the Buddhas are endowed with essence of the Buddha, Tathagata, or nature of the Tathagata. And so the Shenyingpo Chen is a characteristic of sentient beings. And the reason for that is then those three reasons. That Dharmakaya pervades all beings. There is no differentiation between the ultimate nature of the Buddha's mind and the sentient being's mind. And then the potential for attaining Buddhahood exists in all of us. So those are the three main reasons. And then the thesis that is being established through this is to say all beings are endowed with the essence of the Buddha. So the Gelugpa authors generally don't tend to think Buddha nature refers to one thing. So that's where some of the tension is coming from. The Buddha nature refers, it's more like endowed with the essence of the Buddha, so some kind of important essence of the Buddha. And the reason for that is those three things. And now if we push what exactly is Buddha nature, then someone like Gyaltsap would actually refer to the emptiness of the sentient being's mind, as well as the basis of that, which is the natural luminosity of the mind itself. So in other words, one can say there is the conventional nature of the mind, which is the luminosity, and the ultimate nature of the mind, which is the emptiness of the mind. And then they would also, Gelsab would also say that even the potential, the capacity for becoming Buddha is also Tathagata Garbha. So it's the Gelupa authors, including Gelsab particularly, he's very influential because he wrote an extensive commentary on Ratha Gaudavibhaga, don't tend to refer, use the Buddha nature as referring to one thing. So that's where part of the tension is. Now, if you look at on the other end, which is Tsolpopa's approach, then the Buddha nature is referring to one thing. And there too, it is actually a different way of, I mean, it's the Xiantong, and it's also seen as some kind of eternal essence that is endowed. And in some sense, it's actually a Buddha, a fully enlightened, you know, state, present in all beings. So there is a kind of reference to some form, one could argue philosophically, kind of an essentialism. And then in between, you have the spectrum. And between the ultimate emptiness of the sentient being's mind versus the luminosity, then Kagyu tradition, particularly because of the Mahamudra approach, would emphasize the identification of Buddha nature with the luminosity aspect rather than the emptiness aspect. Whereas those who follow Lonten Sherab's kind of commentary and interpretation would emphasize the reference to the emptiness side. So we see a tension there. And part of the tension is really coming from something that is inherent in the Buddhist tradition all the way back, very, very early stages. Because one is, it is very clear and explicit in the teachings of the Buddha as well as the great Indian masters that one of the main emphasis is on negation, removing layers and layers of superimposition that we sentient beings impose on reality, you know, starting from concept of impermanence to no self to emptiness. So there is a very strong thrust on removal of, you know, reifications. But on the other hand, there is also an understanding that the potential exists to become Buddha in all. And that is grounded in the idea of the essential nature of mind being pure and luminous. And that reference to mind as being luminous and pure is found even in the Theravada scriptures as well. So one could say that from a kind of a contemporary philosophical perspective, the tension is coming from whether you emphasize the philosophical ontological dimension, which is the emptiness route, or whether you emphasize the soteriological ethical dimension, which is the ground, you know, ground from which the enlightened qualities come into being. And that tension is there. Now, what the Tibetan tradition has done is to really, especially after Buddhism coming to Tibet, taking up the Buddha nature concept much more explicitly and fleshing it out. We don't see that much in the Indian, other than, of course, in the Ratan Gaudavibhaga. Essentially, the Indian tradition is somewhat silent on the Garbha theory until much later. But it's the Tibetan tradition that really sort of brought it out. So the tension is a very creative one. And, you know, where, and you can read the Tibetan great thinkers like Tsongkhapa and Tolpopa and Sakya Pandita and all of these on a spectrum, like Kamabar Rangchen Dochi, Longchenpa, on a spectrum on where they stand, and which is what makes this whole field of Buddha nature such a fascinating and inspiring kind of, you know, field. Yeah,
fascinating. You describe this as tension, but in some ways, they're just two different approaches, isn't it? And perhaps two approaches meant for two different sets of people, that even in the figure of somebody like Nagarjuna, you see his reductionist scholastic material for those who are more rational thinkers, more gradualist in the approach. And then you have his hymnic writings where he approaches Buddha nature or the nature of the mind more directly in a more sort of romantic, cataphatic manner. And so in some ways, these are two different approaches that are meant for two different sets of people. How do you see that instead of attention? I'm trying to see it as a kind of a synergy. Maybe we can collect these two as well.
Sure. I mean, tension need not necessarily be negative. In some ways, tension is, you know, can be a basis for growth, creative development. Mm-hmm. So I see actually tension, creative tension, as a kind of something that is a positive. Yes, you're right that they are the primary audience to which these types of approaches are being presented may differ because with respect. So human beings are so different. We have different inclinations. We have different sort of, you know, the different ways in which we get inspired and we get motivated. So, but on the other hand, I do believe that some kind of combination of both, depending on where you are in respect to the types of, you know, practitioner, some kind of combination of both is essential. Even for those who approach in a primarily rational, philosophical, emptiness kind of route, I think the more apophatic approach that is found in the Pathathakadagarbha literature is important sources of inspiration, devotion, you know, because they have very powerful evocative language. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at the Tathagatagarbha Sutra and Chirumala Devi Sutra, you can't help but feel inspired because the language is so evocative and inspiring and direct. So in some ways, and then for those who pursue primarily from this more apophatic approach, ultimately cultivation of the view is, you know, unavoidable. And then on the view side, then the more via negativa approach that is emphasized in the Nagarjuna's analytic writing has to be used. So I think a good approach is to find a way in which you combine the both. And that's what actually we see in the writings of, for example, like if you look at Tsongkhapa, in his philosophical writing, he may really emphasize the via negativa approach, the primarily Nagarjuna's analytic corpus. But if you look at his poetry, or if you look at his Vajrayana writing, then the more inspirational, evocative, you know, approach is found. And the same thing we find in the great Tibetan masters.
Yeah, so even within the Gelug tradition, I think often we have this rather cliche understanding that Buddha nature is totally equated with emptiness and not so much with luminosity. But if you actually go into the Vajrayana writings of Tsongkhapa, you would find quite a lot of discussion of clear light and luminosity.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because the thing is, ultimately, one of the key messages that the Buddha nature teaching is bringing is that all the stains, the afflictions that we have are advantages. They are not inherent part of the mind, and they are ultimately removable because the nature of mind is luminous, it is pure. So that. That is a fundamental Mahayana view, and it doesn't really matter which Tibetan traditions you affiliate yourself. That is a fundamental, and without this, there is no foundation for understanding the possibility of attaining enlightenment, because the enlightenment, you know, has to be accounted for, and then the basis of that is because the essential of nature of mind is pure, it's luminous. So, and then there are, you know, in Ratnagoda Vibhaga, there's Timalubu Wanyi Tayunderachin Yiden Chir. So the stains are adventitious and qualities are naturally inherent. So those are powerful concepts, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then even when we talk about emptiness, I want to come to emptiness. Now, a lot of the people would interpret the Gelugpa understanding of emptiness as one that is absence of inherent existence, and not associate with the kind of emptiness that free from all elaborations, taking the Indian sources literally. But can one actually say that Tsongkhapa also presents that type of emptiness at certain level?
Well, this whole debate on you know, what exactly is emptiness? How do we characterize emptiness? And whether it is simply defined in terms of non-implicative negation as, you know, absence of inherent existence, or whether there is something that can be characterized as, you know, beyond all elaborations. To some extent, I think the debate, to be honest, is semantic. Because if you look at Tsongkhapa's writings, although he emphasizes the language of absence, he understands this absence to be inclusive of going beyond all elaborations. Even the tertel, this is the absence of elaboration. Tertel itself is a negation because telwa is a freedom and it's a negation. So the key point he's making is that the moment we use language and concept to approach emptiness, to define emptiness, you know, we just cannot go beyond the language of negation. And also this is where, because, you know, one of the things Tsongkhapa's critics don't fully appreciate is what is meant by the absence of inherent existence. Because some of his critics often take an example of absence of non-implicative negation as for example, like absence of elephant in the room. And because elephant is identified, so absence of an elephant in the room is simply a negation. They take that as a paradigmatic example and then apply it to Tsongkhapa's understanding of emptiness. Whereas Tsongkhapa is essentially saying that those who approach emptiness through analytic method, our task is to, you know, go ever deeper into removing the layers and layers of superimposition. So what it is empty of, what it is absence of, that is in concept of inherent existence, identifying that, understanding that, what it means for things if they were to be intrinsically real. So the absence of intrinsic existence in a language is similar to absence of elephant in the room, but that similarity is purely at the linguistic level. in one context, it's a simple negation of elephant in the room, but in another context, it's a negation of projected inherent existence onto reality, which assumption of which is very deep. So in other words, even to understand fully what Tsongkhapa means by absence of inherent existence, one has to really go beyond all elaborations, because any conceptual elaboration cannot be, you know, compatible with emptiness. So I think to some extent, the debate is semantic. Mm. Now, if from Tsongkhapa's point of view, if one, the absence of elaboration is, you know, beyond negation, then Tsongkhapa would argue that there is a danger of reifying something in an affirmative sense. And the moment you reify something in an affirmative sense, then the, you know, inherent existence sneaks in from a backdoor, if you want. So I think it's a more complicated debate. And that's why, for example, like Junpei Pham, who actually criticized some of aspects of Tsongkhapa's you know, philosophy of emptiness, but actually admits that the logical structure of emptiness is best captured by mere negation. Mm. You know, Junpei Pham actually explicitly states this. Mm. And then similarly in Shajia Chotin, who was also a vehement critic of Tsongkhapa, actually says that if you take the Prasangika literature as your ultimate final definition of emptiness, then the logical structure of emptiness is via, you know, mere negation. So I think it's a bit more complex, you know, debate.
But if we take it from the perspective of the experience of emptiness or realization of emptiness,
sure.
Often the understanding is that the Gelug understanding is there has to be a cognitive sort of perception or realization of something, as in there is an objectification, whereas you have the other schools that are often attacking the guru position, saying that your mind actually is free from any kind of apprehension and fixation, no mikpa.
Yeah.
So from that point of view, I actually found that maybe Tsongkhapa also in some contexts accepts the lack of apprehension or mikpa, or some kind
well,
of
illness. And here that's where sort of getting into the weeds. You know, the, a part of the challenge is some of these terms like mikpa and you know, and then in some Madhyamaka literature, the word ne is used, like locus, ne meba. And then the yul object. And then Tsongkhapa would argue and admit that the realization of emptiness has emptiness as its object. So in this sense, there is an object. But on the other hand, if you tease out what exactly is the object, there is no object. That's just pure absence.
Yes.
It's just a pure absence. And in fact, he says in one of his Guide to the View text that when you meditate on emptiness, even at the beginner's level, a successful meditation on emptiness has to be felt as if the mind itself has become empty. You know, because otherwise, if there is a separation between mind and emptiness, then it becomes tonyi yang che to. So it's like the emptiness becomes something out there. So, so he is actually, I mean, he doesn't emphasize the language of no object, you know, but he's, because he wants to maintain the logical character of the subjective experience. But he says from a phenomenological perspective, from the perspective of the person who's actually meditating on emptiness, then there has to be a fusion of the meditating mind and emptiness, and there should not be any separation. So he's, you know, the difference isn't that great, but where Tsongkhapa is important is that he's very careful about language. He's really very, very careful about language, and he also wants to flesh out you know, all the details. And but experientially, he admits, you know, he recognizes that the real experience of emptiness has to take the form of mind itself becoming empty, it becoming almost as if it's fused. You know, he says, sim mikpa la shukpa tabo, so tongpanyi la shukpa tabo. So it's like as if the mind itself has fused into emptiness.
Yeah, I think this is probably what he captured in the final part of his Lamzo Namsum.
Yes.
Because
yeah.
Scholars like Jumifam would critique him for his more, let's say, his graduated approach of focusing on inherent existence as the object of negation initially, but then at the same time, would praise Tsongkhapa for having reached the ultimate sort of emptiness free from elaborations,
yes,
and offer cites Lamso Namsum to support that. And I was actually reading his Lamrim. The middle Lamrims has even Tsongkhapa saying that when we talk about illa mijepa or mitokpa, non-conceptuality, non-mentation, is something that we don't normally think that Tsongkhapa or the Gelugpa scholars promote, but he says there is illa mijepa which comes haktong or vipassana of emptiness,
sure.
And one without it. So it seems even illa mijepa is in the language or.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, where one of the things, you know, that Tsongkhapa does is to really kind of tease out the language like mitokpa, because mitokpa, quite often people immediately take it as non-conceptual, tokpa meba. And non-conceptual tokpa meba or mitokpa in that sense, dogme, is a complicated concept because of the influence of Dharmakirti and Dignaga's epistemology, in which case then there is no concept. Whereas Tsongkhapa is also saying that there is a usage of the word mitokpa, which is more like a non-discursive. So then it's a sort of a modality of a meditative practice. So shinne practices generally tend to be non-discursive because you are not, you know, approaching with the activity of the mind. So you're simply resting on the object of the meditation without any movement. So mitokpa is like thinking in terms of X, Y, and Z. So this mitokpa is not exactly non-conceptual, because there is still some degree of thought. So I think this is where the differentiation of language becomes important. Yeah. And then for example, like one of the most important proponent of Yila Mechepa, non-mentation from the Indian tradition, is Maitrepa. Mm-hmm. And Maitrepa actually argues that Yila Mechepa can be read as mentation of what is absence. So it's a very interesting, because Yila Mechepa need not necessarily be from non-mentation. It could be a mentation of a non. Absence. Yeah.
Yeah, he works on the term amanasikara.
Exactly, amanasikara, yeah.
It's manasikara of ah.
Exactly. So, yeah.
So my final question before we open up to the audience, when we talk about topics like emptiness and Buddha nature, sometimes I fear that the Tibetan scholarly world, irrespective of all of what tradition you belong to, come with a very insular, isolated sort of approach. In that, for instance, when you talk about Hashang in Tibetan philosophical literature, Hashang is sort of presented as somebody who is nihilistic and almost a heretical teacher. But then we know Hashang probably represented the Chan form of Buddhism. We have Zen Buddhism across the world.
Exactly. Yeah.
So when we try to sort of think about Buddha nature, is it sort of, I want to get your opinion on this. Would it be possible that not only the Buddhists, including Tibetan Buddhists, Zen Buddhists, and so forth, but also even some of the other religious mystics, people like Gnostics from Christianity or Adyavedantists from Hinduism, would they also be not able to, is there a possibility that they could actually experience Buddha nature? Just like the Tibetan the nature of mind.
That's a really good question, because even though the teachings like Buddha nature and emptiness are in the Buddhist tradition, but the Buddhist ideas of them are meant to be universal. The Buddha nature, the Buddhists are not saying Buddha nature is found only among Buddhists, or emptiness is applicable, relevant only to the Buddhists. So clearly, especially in the mystical tradition, I would personally say yes, because if you look at the idea of an immanent God and the spark within, and if you look at some of the Indian bhakti traditions, beautiful poetry of Shiva being inside everyone, they are powerful. And essentially what the Buddha nature teaches us, for me at least, is that the basic nature of sentient being is goodness. Mm. So the potential for perfection exists in all of us. And so, and one of the beautiful arguments in Ratha Goda Vibhaga is that if there is no Buddha nature, then why is it that we naturally move towards happiness? Mm. Which I think is a very, very interesting argument. The fact that we are, moving towards goodness, we're moving towards happiness, is so fundamental in sentient nature that it must say something very deep about who we are as a species. So yeah, I would agree. I mean, of course, as a Buddhist, I would still maintain that, to get to like Cholam, Tonglam, and Jorlam, then I think you have to have something similar to what especially the teaching on no self has to be an important part of that.
Well, thank you. I, as an authority, I want to get your...
Not as an authority, as another scholar.
because I think Tibetan Buddhist scholars ought to now open up to other spiritual traditions as well and really study them more sort of carefully, and instead of just dismissing them as heretical views.
And yeah, Chirupa, Mutikpa, Tibetans love to do that. Partly because in Tibet, there were no Mutikpas, and that's part of the reason, because there was no one there to defend and fully explain the position,
Okay, with that, let us see if there are questions. I think there are quite a number. Marcus, will you?
Yes, there are many questions coming in, and I could try to summarize some of them. One that's sort of repeated in various ways several times here is about bliss and emptiness and the connection there, and just wondering about, how can a mere negation be blissful, and what's that concept about the non-duality of bliss and emptiness about?
So that's a good question. So that actually is where the creative tension between the compassion, emptiness, and Buddha nature really gets fleshed out in at least in the Tsongkhapa's view. Because in Vajrayana tradition, particularly the highest yoga tantra, there is this understanding that the natural tone of consciousness, especially when it's brought at the subtle level, is blissful. And that bliss is not in a sensational a sense of a sensation. So that bliss is sort of a consequence of having quietened all the layers of conceptual elaborations. So in fact, there is a beautiful passage in Sarjan Losa Gyaltso's hymn to Vajrayogini, which is Vajrayogini is part of my practice, and Vajrayogini in the Gelug tradition came from the Sakya tradition, and Sarjan Losa Gyaltso was a great Sakya master, and there's a poem where he says that the youth who's so exhausted by the conceptual elaboration seeks respite and peace in the forest of still forest of inexpressible reality. So there is this idea that when the conceptual elaborations and thoughts and layers of thoughts are quietened, then the bliss arises. There is a kind of a now in the Gelug tradition, the union of bliss and emptiness is really, takes place at a subtle level of consciousness when the grosser levels of thoughts have been quietened. And at that point, the mind's essential nature is luminous, and then mind is naturally empty of inherent existence. And then the realization of emptiness is the realization of mind's own nature. And that is experientially felt. So that's why there is no subject-object duality. So non-dual is in that sense. Kamala, your sound. Yeah, okay.
So I suppose one could also say that sometimes you approach bliss through emptiness, as you explained, that a bodhisattva would have the experience of emptiness, which leads to immense bliss. And that's what the first stage is called, pramudita, great joy. Sure. And perhaps there are others who would approach emptiness through bliss, particularly using the tantric part of method.
Exactly, I mean, Tsongkhapa also says that at an advanced level of tantric practice, Vajrayana practice, especially when bliss is brought in, then the discursive approach that is so characteristic of analytic method needs to be, stopped.
So there are many other questions here. I'll try for a slightly different type here, a straightforward question. For a lay person, how do I know the essence of Buddha nature exists in me?
That's a good question. Ratna Goda Vibhaga basically says that the fact that we seek happiness is an important indication. And also, from a kind of a contemporary kind of perspective, the argument could be that we have a natural capacity to empathize with someone else's suffering, because if we purely take Darwinian evolutionary thinking, then it's very difficult to explain why should I care for someone else's problem. But we know from our own personal experience that the capacity to care and feel empathetic towards others is very inherent in us as human beings. So those are powerful indicators of our natural inclination towards goodness, towards kindness, and towards compassion. So that is what I would argue is, you know, something that any contemporary person can relate to.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. From Facebook, there's a question about how we might integrate emptiness and luminosity and ideas of Buddha nature with politics, with strategies, public policies, development. I don't know if you have any comments on that, but several people are asking about that.
I don't know. I mean, that's a tricky one. But generally, there are important general lessons that we can take from teachings on both sides. For example, from the emptiness side, one of the key messages that is coming out of emptiness is to don't trust too much in your thoughts. Because we, you know, often a lot of our sort of anger and sense of kind of, you know, rightness comes from the fact that we are deluded. So emptiness teaching is pointing out that the way in which we see the world to a large extent is a construct of our own mind and our biases. So I think just taking that into account is helpful, especially even in politics, which involve complicated human relationships, then being able to constantly ask, am I seeing, looking at the situation in the right way? Is there something that I'm bringing because of my own biases? So those are, I mean, of course, I'm not saying that's a practice of emptiness, but that's important lesson being brought from emptiness, constantly asking the question, you know, what is it that I'm bringing into a situation that is not there? Are there elements that are being brought in because of who I am, because of my biases? That I think is an important one. From the Buddha nature side, in complex relationship, particularly in the political and administrative section, where we are, you know, often put in a situation where we have to disagree with people, and, you know, dealing with disagreements and diverse opinions is an important part of even leadership skill. Again, there, coming and taking important lessons from the Buddha nature teaching, where, you know, the seed for perfection and seed for Buddhahood is present in all beings. And that can also be a powerful factor for recognizing shared humanity, you know, shared common humanity, because just as I wish to be happy, this person wishes to be happy. Just as I do not want suffering, this person does not want suffering. And recognizing that basic, not forgetting the basic humanness of the other person, then helps you actually have a much better attitude and state of mind in dealing with, even in a difficult situation. So there are clearly, I'm not saying that's the Buddha nature teaching, but what I'm saying is there are important lessons that can be taken from these teachings and brought even in everyday reality, where on the surface, it seems they're totally unconnected.
I just want to add to what Geshe-la has just shared. When we discussed the purpose of Buddha nature teachings in the Ratnagotra Vibhaga, the ultimate continuum, there are five purposes given. And I think two would be very relevant to politicians. One is really belittling others, no?
Yeah.
Sort of looking down on your opponents or people who are different. And so I think Buddha nature is definitely, or understanding that everyone has Buddha nature definitely would help get over sort of supremacist thinking, yeah, bigotry, discrimination. And then another one is saying Buddha nature teachings help you get over self-love and self-attachment. If you're, yeah, too arrogant and too, sure, puffed with pride,
sure.
Everyone having the same. I think it's very clearly in the Ratnagotra Vibhaga, these sort of purposes.
And also one of the purposes that was pointed, or benefits that has been pointed out in the text, is giving a sense of confidence and courage. Because often, you know, we feel down and we feel discouraged and demoralized. And then the Buddha nature teaching tells us that we have the capacity even to become a Buddha. I mean, that is an ambitious, you know, kind of suggestion. So if we can, if we have the potential and the capacity to become even a Buddha, then of course we should be able to, you know, have the capacity to overcome all sorts of problems. So giving that courage and confidence is also an important part of that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Great. There's another question here. Coming back to the specifics of Buddha nature, could you address how impermanence is itself a feature of Buddha nature?
It's difficult to say impermanence is a feature of Buddha nature. I mean, impermanence is part of the nature of reality of all conditioned things. And then even when we identify or emphasize the luminosity as an important aspect of the Buddha nature, everyday level, even the luminosity of the mind is a conditioned phenomena, which is, you know, subject to impermanence from, you know, moment to moment, although the continuity remains. So in that sense, one can say it's an attribute of the mind, but it's difficult to say it's an attribute of the Buddha nature itself.
But Geshe-la, just to take this a little further, among Tibetan thinkers, you have these different groups, some saying Buddha nature or luminosity of mind is impermanent, yeah, and then others saying they're totally permanent, hypostatic,
exactly,
entities.
Sure.
Right, I think that question's probably trying to draw you out and on that, again, that dynamic between those two approaches. Yeah, wonderful. There's kind of a lot of different questions coming in across the spectrum here. Further questions about the nature of Buddha nature and emptiness. One question coming back to what you said, Tsongkhapa said about mind meditating on emptiness becoming fused with emptiness. Does this happen regardless of the basis of that emptiness? Does it mean one will have that experience whether we meditate on emptiness of one's own mind or the emptiness of flower? There are several similar questions like that.
Yes, I mean, Tsongkhapa meant for any type of basis you may choose to meditate on emptiness, but if you're a meditator primarily kind of interested in practice, you know, it's in our self-interest to choose something like mind or the nature of the self, because why choose some external object which has hardly any sort of relevance to our everyday life? You know, of course, on a logical level, you know, one would want to understand the nature of emptiness, you know, apply to all phenomena. But when it comes to actual practice, you know, it is more judicious to choose something that would make an impact. So, and if we choose something like a flower externally, the impact would be less. Whereas if you choose the nature of mind, one's own mind, it's more powerful. And in fact, one of the important teachings that I take from the Buddha nature teaching is the idea that, you know, in the end, where the practice of emptiness and meditation of emptiness matters most is when you apply it to your own mind, the nature of your own mind. And in fact, one of the powerful arguments that is used for why, you know, stains are advantageous is because the mind itself is empty. So there is a beautiful passage in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, where it says that mind is, devoid of mind because the nature of mind is luminous or clear light. So, and the idea is that many of the stains, especially the afflictions, arise from ignorance, and ignorance particularly of the nature of mind. So in a meditation, if you take the nature of mind itself as the basis for practice, then the impact on the practitioner will be much more powerfully felt. So I think this is where, and here I would say that the Mahamudra approach, particularly as proposed in the Kagyu tradition, is a very powerful practice, which has been adopted in the Gelug tradition as well, you know, for example, in Panchen Lama's Mahamudra text. And in, you know, and the Panchen Lama's Mahamudra approach is teaching is actually traced to an oral teaching of the Tsongkhapa. So this kind of Mahamudra approach is a very, very powerful practice, because there then you are taking mind as the basis of your meditation, including even of emptiness itself.
Can I query you on something? The emptiness of flower came up, and I think one of the things you come across, especially as a sort of refutation of thinkers who equate Buddha nature with emptiness, is would other things also have Buddha nature, because they are also empty? They
yes, have empty. Yes.
So I wonder what kind of response the Gelug thinkers give to that. But even beyond that, I want to get your opinion again. Now, when you, for instance, look into Zen Buddhism, there's some kind of Buddha nature in all things.
That's true.
Yeah. I think Dzogchen Rigpa also comes with a similar kind of universality of Buddha nature, or awareness at least. So what's your take on these?
That's a tricky one. I think the attribution of Buddha nature to inanimate objects is a complicated one. I'm quite sure Tsongkhapa would not, you know, accept that. And also the emptiness, the Buddha nature, the emptiness being Buddha nature is not any kind of emptiness. It's the emptiness of an unenlightened mind, timada jibesen. And in fact, there is a beautiful, a short letter that Tsongkhapa writes to one of his devotees from Ganden. This is means it's towards the end of his life, where he talks about how the unenlightened mind, the TJSM, the mind endowed with, you know, sort of polluted mind, is the basis, the ground. And the wisdom and method are the path, and the two kayas, the form and dharmakaya, are the result. So in fact, he takes the polluted mind of sentient beings to be actually the ground of practice. So the Buddha nature equation with emptiness is not just emptiness in general. It is the emptiness of an unenlightened mind. So that's why I think the extension to other inanimate objects wouldn't apply here. But your reference to Zen and others thinking about this natural purity that is present in all things, that's an interesting one, because it almost become sort of panpsychic. You know, and there I have also wondered about, the other Tibetan traditions, masters, including Mipham and Longchenpa, who understand the ultimate truth, or Tantam Denpa, ultimately in the sense of a non-duality of sphere and awareness, Yingrik, Yerme. In that case, then, you know, one of the things that everybody understands and accepts is that when we talk about ultimate truth, then we are talking about ultimate truth of all things, not just sentient beings. So if Ingri Nyeme, non-duality of sphere and awareness, is the ultimate reality, then it should be applicable to all things, not just sentient beings. So then what the Zen teachers and others are saying is becoming quite similar. But I haven't seen any work myself that has really tried to flesh out what this means and the implications and the consequences of that view.
Marcus, shall we take one or two more questions, and then perhaps we close the session?
Sure. Sure. So there is a question. Since you're a master translator, there's a question related to translation here. from someone who's actually translating some works regarding debates on Buddha nature in Tibet, especially related to the Drukpa Kagyu tradition. So how can we recognize or differentiate more semantic arguments of terminologies without misregarding them, or maybe they mean misrepresenting them, in complex debates as just or merely semantic? As you mentioned, many of these terminologies go way back to India, but are only spelled out in all their diversity in Tibet and have changed extremely in their definition and meaning. For example, Yidlamichepa. Now, this can sometimes be very difficult. So I guess they're asking you to comment a bit on that.
Well, that's a really good question, actually. And I'm glad that you are actually thinking along these lines, because, and by the way, master translator is probably not a good attribute to me, because, you know, strictly speaking, in the translation world, you are supposed to be a good translator, or best translator is supposed to be translating into their own mother tongue, not in the opposite direction. So a best translator into English has to be a native English speaker. I just happen to be the opposite one. But you are right. It's difficult to distinguish, you know, whether the arguments ultimately boils down to some semantic disagreement, or whether the debate and the diversity of opinion has something that is quite substantial. And that, I think, is something that you as the translator has to kind of, you know, analyze. But as a translator, it is also important to be faithful to the author or the voice you are translating. You know, for example, if I'm translating Tsongkhapa, there may be sections of the text where actually I would personally read the text in a different way. Because I'm another human being, even though I'm a Gelugpa, a great admirer of Tsongkhapa and devoted, but also I have my own intellect. But on the other hand, if I'm translating it, I cannot bring my reading, superseding the master's reading. So if you're working on a, say, for Drukpa Kagyu master's text, if the Drukpa Kagyu master is taking that debate as a substantive difference, then you as the translator in your translation of it has to be taking it seriously as a substantive difference and reading it that way. But if you have a different opinion about, you know, there being a semantic dimension, then you can put it in a footnote, which is the footnotes is not by the author, footnotes is by the translator. So that's what makes the modern literary conventions quite helpful for us to flesh out some of these things. But when an author takes a difference seriously, then the translator should also take the difference very seriously. Because why would that author spend so much time and energy trying to make the case and make the differentiation? So I think there's a kind of a different layers of approach that you need to bring in.
Well, Marcus, is that the last question?
Well, there are too many questions to get to.
Okay. So why don't we take two more and then we'll stop?
Yes.
Okay, that sounds good. So there are a couple questions also about different ways in which Gelugpas present some concepts. I'm not going to be able to ask all of them here, so I'm just going to ask one of them. This is maybe a little bit detailed, but would the great Gelug scholar Tempel Dronme's exposition of the Uttara Tantra be different from mainstream Gelugpa tradition?
Khongdan Tenpe Dronme. I don't think so. This is Khongdan Tenpe Dronme, the 18th century master. Although I haven't actually read any of his very explicitly on Buddha nature. Generally, the mainstream Gelug authors tend to follow Gyaltsabje's writing on Buddha nature quite closely, especially his Uttara Tantra commentary. But if you look at, there are later authors who will bring a more tantric dimension. For example, like the Seven Dalai Lama has a beautiful commentary on a sutra, Dagaishige Dondel. And Dagaishige Dondel has this famous line, which Sakya Pandita really kind of critiqued, where it says that if you know your mind, you are enlightened. You know, semtona sangya orjuru. And this is actually coming from Dagaishige Do. It's a sutra, and Sakya Pandita critiques this extensively. And it's also in that context, Sapen takes the Buddha nature concept as metaphorical or provisional, not ultimate, not definitive. So in the seventh Dalai Lama's commentary on that sutra, he brings in the Vajrayana dimension, because one of the things the Buddha nature concept brings, especially when you combine with Vajrayana, is a sort of a deeper understanding of how the Buddha's form body arises. Because if you rely simply on the non-Vajrayana literature, say Madhyamaka or Prajnaparamita literature, although there is a very robust account of how Dharmakaya can be attained, but there is not that compelling account of how the Rupakaya, the form body, arises, because the form body somehow seems to pop up from nowhere. And one of the important concepts in Mahayana Buddhism is that Buddhahood is not sought outside from elsewhere. So the whatever is arising as a Buddha, Buddha's embodiment, the seeds of them, their basis of them, their ground has to be present even in sentient beings. But in the non-Vajrayana literature, it's very difficult to find a compelling account of how the form body arises. And there in the Gelug literature, you know, Vajrayana, especially highest yoga tantra explanation, is really sought. And this is one area where, for example, the seven Dalai Lama's commentary on that sutra is a beautiful example of how to fuse the Buddha nature teachings with the Vajrayana perspective.
How does Dharmakaya differ from Buddha nature?
Well, again, here the term Dharmakaya is used in many different ways. So that's one thing that we have to remember, because one of the important thing, particularly if people are interested in kind of language and translation and textual study, is always to remember, keep in mind that the Wittgensteinian idea, that the meaning of a word is its use. So, and also being very sensitive to the context in which the term is used. Now, if we are using it in a classical non-Vajrayana Indian sort of Mahayana context, then Dharmakaya is, one could see Dharmakaya as the Buddha body of reality. So Buddha's ultimate nature itself is Dharmakaya. And it has two aspects. One is the wisdom aspect, which is the Jnana Dharmakaya, and one is the Svabhava Dharmakaya, which is the Buddha's reality as it is. But then if you look at the Vajrayana text, as well as in Kagyu Mahamudra literature, then Dharmakaya is used not necessarily in a very kind of, you know, confined way of referring only to the resultant state. Dharmakaya sometimes is also used at the level of ground. For example, the nature of mind itself can be characterized as Dharmakaya. So I think it is important to be sensitive to the context in which the term is being used. And just because in one particular context it is used, say for example, in the classical Mahayana tradition, used only in the resultant state, doesn't mean the term Dharmakaya cannot be used in a different way elsewhere. So I think that's important to remember. And sometimes there are sutras that would equate Dharmakaya with emptiness. You know, Chöge Ying, you know, Dharma Dadu, Dharmakaya, and Shunyata, they equate it. So we find diverse uses of the term. And just because it is being used in a particular way, it does not mean it needs to be used always in that way in different contexts.
Thank you, Jintala. Karma, what do you think? Any more questions?
Well, I have many questions, and I think there are also many other questions from the audience, but I think we'll probably have to sort of call this session. Sure. And but I hope you will come back again to discuss Buddha nature in the context of your other works, like you have translated the Tibetan Book of the Dead, you have also done the Book of Kadam, and then Fearless Heart, how the courage to be compassionate can transform lives. So we do hope you'll join us again.
Definitely. I mean, it's a real pleasure to be sitting down with someone like you and having the space and the courage and the intellect to delve deeply into these. So it's really wonderful. So please, you know, it'll be my pleasure and honor.
Yes. And I have a final question now. This is partly because we are both sort of sons of the Himalayas, Buddhist Himalayas. our Himalayan Buddhist culture is informed by concepts like emptiness and Buddha nature. The whole value system is based on such principles. If we were to reach such values, such concepts to our own young people outside the monastic scholastic centers, what would be your advice? What should the young Tibetans and the Bhutanese, in what way should we be able to spread these concepts and messages to them?
Well, thank you. That's a really important question. And also right now it's important because, you know, one of the things that I worry about our time is the, you know, in the globalized world, access and exposure to multiple ideas is part of that reality. And in that reality, you know, which story gets told and which story that you, you know, resonate with becomes an important issue. So, and I know, for example, like in the West particularly, where the public space and discourse is secular, conception of human nature is very, very influenced by a kind of a particular Darwinian reading of human beings as being profit maximizers, pursuit of self-interest being the key driver of human behavior, human motivation, and autonomy and independence is a key cultural societal value. So in this so there is also a kind of a strong emphasis on hedonism, you know, that you make your life and you are your master, which is in a way, even the Buddha says that you are your own master, but he meant it in a different way. So in this kind of context, I think paying attention to the great insights in our own tradition, inherent tradition, is an important one. For example, like the Buddha nature teaching tells us that we have the capacity to be, even become a Buddha. That's a powerful, powerful message. You know, I mean, that's a source of courage. And it also tells us that the impulse for kindness, impulse for compassion, is a very natural part of who we are as a sentient creature. In fact, in the Buddhist tradition, we define sentient being as those who are capable of experiencing pain and pleasure. So the capacity to experience pain is a fundamental reality of who we are as sentient. And it's because of this, we cannot tolerate to see someone else suffer because we're immediately able to identify. So those things, and also one of the important teachings of the Buddha nature is that the capacity for knowledge is in us, you know, the wisdom. And in fact, you know, to read Buddha nature, some of the scriptures literally, in some sense, we are kind of even enlightened already. We don't know. I mean, that's a little going too far, but even in a metaphoric sense, that's a powerful message. So all of this really gives us a way of seeing who we are as a human being, very different from the typical Darwinian evolutionary theory story. That I think is really important because, you know, the way we see ourselves, the story we tell for ourselves is going to influence how we treat others. And so those kind of things are really important. And also one of the things that I would like to encourage the younger generation is to also rejoice in the fact that we are born into a cultural context where we have these inherited, you know, as part of our heritage, these great teachings and wisdom. So I think those are important because in the end, even though we may be living in a globalized world, but, you know, each of us has to make sense of our own life. Each of us has to find a purpose. And it's way more effective to find that meaning and purpose that would involve or include embracing the great teachings and wisdom of the great masters of the past, so that you're not, whereas in the secular, purely secular world, you are expected to create your own meaning, you know, make sense of your existence without recourse to any traditional teachings. Whereas in our own tradition, you know, we have great reverence, deep reverence to the masters like the Buddha and great teachers of the past. So I think those are important, you know, points I would share with the younger generation.
Unmute. Thank you, Gisela, for that advice. And I think for a lot of people, both young people or people from the Himalayas and also elsewhere in the world, a good place to start would be really the Library of Tibetan Classics that Gisela, you are leading. And then anyone interested in knowing more about Buddha Nature, do please visit the Buddha Nature website, sponsored by Tsardra Foundation. So with that, once again, Gisela, thank you very much for joining us. And thank you everyone, wherever you are in the world, for joining us. Have a good day, good night.
Thank you, Lavana.
So much.
And thank you, Marcus, as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.